Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. What an energetic hello, hello. Journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Oh, hi there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
It's springtime in Los Angeles. Who could be having a bad time? And Jesse Thorne has suggested a new epithet for you. Pop culture scholar Karen Thompson.
Hi, Guy, and hi, Rutgers.
Hello, Karen. I guess maybe it is best that we not include hate speech when introducing you. I thought it was fun, though.
I mean, you know.
But we're reclaiming it.
Dyke About Town will live forever.
I know.
Oh, man. Oh, I forgot about that. Long live Dyke About Town.
Yes. We'll break it out for a special occasion.
Exactly.
Exactly. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to talk about Jordan Peele's directorial debut, Get Out. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest gems. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have got our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I haven't talked about a book in a while, so I wanted to talk about a memoir that I just finished reading that I really loved. It's by an author named Jesmyn Ward. The memoir is called Men We Reaped. It came out in 2013, and it's really a devastating, beautiful book about how she lost five different men in her life within the span of 5 years, all from her small hometown in Mississippi. One of the people she loses is her brother. And she basically has a chapter devoted to each one. And then there are also just details about her childhood in this poor bayou town. And it's really all those deaths she links back basically to how difficult it is to be a black man in America. All the men die in different ways. So it's not as if she's just kind of going with the obvious ties. There's a lots of extrapolation and really, you know, summoning the kind of life that these particular men are kind of destined to live because of lesser resources and things like that. And it also really brilliantly details the struggle of women as well. She talks about her mother and her grandmother and how both of them just never stopped working because basically, for different reasons, the men weren't in the household. And so everything fell to these women. They just had to do everything for themselves. And it's a really just incredibly moving book and beautifully written, really poetic, but also stark at the same time. She's written a few books now. One of them that maybe people have heard of is called Salvage the Bones, that got a National Book Award in 2011. And last year she came out with an anthology called The Fire This Time that's kind of a play on James Baldwin's book. I recommend it. It's really marvelous.
That sounds intense.
It is intense. But, you know, it actually is strangely uplifting because the ties in the community with herself and all these sort of like cousins and friends and brothers and sisters she grew up with, it's just they are so there for one another.
Yeah.
And it's really touching and moving. The fact that like when there's one death, kind of even a peripheral character, it really just like ripples out and they all just are there for each other.
Is this a small town?
Yeah, a really small town called DeLille, something like that in Mississippi. And close to New Orleans, but she talks about Katrina, too, the kind of ravages of Katrina and even it kind of rippling out all the way to that town.
I feel like our African-American narratives are so dominated by urban narratives that we don't talk about, like, the small town African America that, you know, has existed forever in the South.
Yeah, it's like a different experience than like Detroit or St. Louis or Los Angeles or wherever. You know, it's the small town poor experience, and it really shows you that to be poor in the South is a different kind of poor.
Yeah.
And we don't often think about that. And I think, you know, even in the last election we saw some of that sort of fear and anger with like the poor Southerners kind of lash out.
Yeah. Karen, what are you all about this week?
Because I can't talk about Top Chef again, I thought it.
But why not, Karen? Why not?
Like, I can't belabor this point, but I did.
It's not because she doesn't want to have. She's not scared about the podcast being repetitive. She's just scared about her wife hearing her talk about Brooke even more.
I know. Too many platforms. But I did want to bring a food pop culture related story in. And despite all of the many horrific things I could bring up about Donald Trump, whatever we want to call him, 45, I found it particularly horrifying that this man went to a premier steakhouse in the United States called BLT and ordered a New York strip well done and ate it with ketchup.
This is fascinating because the thing he's supposed to, like, he's supposed to be good at golf and eating steak.
Yeah.
Like, Karen?
How could you be so terrible at eating steak, especially when you have steaks branded with your name, right? You know, he's basically endorsing the fact that the meat that he shills is probably not high quality enough to be, like, consumed in the proper way. But, you know, there are many reasons that people will order a steak well done. And, you know, part of it, if I'm going to give it a generous read, is generational.
Yeah.
People who were born in a time when refrigeration was scant, or who have, you know, or come from places or regions where that was the case, have some suspicion around eating their meat bloody or, you know, with any not being undercooked in any way. My own mom, actually, for the longest time, would order steaks well done, and I would kind of flip out a little bit about it, and finally got her to like notch down to medium well. But I understand that for her and for my grandmother, you know, growing up in the Philippines, it's like, you know, the beef that we consume there is generally braised or stewed or something like that, you know, for preservation and longevity. But this is a person who's had, Trump is a person who's had access to the gold-plated finer things in life. And, you know, I'm pretty sure he's had a fridge his entire life. So this is simply just an indication of how, what a germaphobe he is.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
It seems so deeply paranoid in a way. Like, from anyone else, I'd just be like, whatever. But from him, it just fits into his personality profile as, like, yet another indicator that he trusts nothing and no one.
Well, also, it feels like a little bit like an underloved child, where a person started doing this when they were six, and nobody ever just said, hey, buddy.
Try something new.
Yeah.
And then I also think, like, even in this discussion we're having right now, there are a lot of people that are his base that think that's just perfectly fine and are more than willing to also put that ketchup on some noodles. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to criticize his choice, his culinary choices, because he should know better. But I can see, like, that story would be manipulated in a way that would empower his base and be like, so what if he doesn't, like, actually want
fancy
steak?
He's just a regular guy.
Yeah. Regular Joe.
But that's a very interesting point because, like,
Americans love their mead.
But there's also something very liberal about wanting to do it the right and cultured way. Where, like, for somebody like my dad, who was a lifelong Republican, it was, I like it how I like it. And you don't tell me.
Yeah.
And that's very, like, authoritarian.
And I mean, the concept of, like, having steak rare or medium rare is a foodie kind of concept.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think people really, like, thought about that until, like, the 90s kind of, like, foodie wave.
No, people thought about that starting in the 60s and the 50s. I mean, like, in the mid-century.
Joan Crawford ate, you know, like, practically a rare
people
steak.
People had steak tartare all the time. And, you know, like, people had, you know, but I do want to, like, throw in just one of the better commentaries I read about this particular incident. And it's a quote from Helen Rosner on Eater. A person who won't eat this steak, his steak any doneness but well is a person who won't entertain the notion that there could be a better way. A person who blankets the whole thing in ketchup is always going to fix his problems by making them worse. So, you know, so it's sort of like, and also the cut of steak. Let's just talk for one more second about the cut of steak that he did this to.
Which was?
It's a New York strip bone-in, which is not very well marbled. It's very toothsome and textured and a bit grainy. And so to cook that all the way, to cook that all the way is to essentially turn it into this, like, inedible piece.
It's like a dried piece
chew.
Of doo-doo.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a tragic story from a tragic person. Let's hope this ends tragically for him. Winter Mitchell.
He's totally going to get poisoned by a well-done steak.
Yeah, totally.
Winter, what are you all about this week?
I know you guys are talking about this next week when I'm gone for a South By, but Feud debuted last night. Ryan Murphy's really, you know, restrained pilot. I think that there's a lot of ground to cover. So I feel like this is a very specific show for very specific types of people. Robert Osborne, who was the, in my opinion, the reason.
Heart and soul of TCM.
Heart and soul of TCM. I mean, you know, it pains me to say that he passed away today. But I thought about sort of the whole context of, like, classic film and then having these two women who were very big movie stars. But they were very big movie stars in a way that made sense up until a point, and they didn't get the memo. So yeah. the studio tried to give them the memo. The audiences tried to give them a memo. They were sort of pushed off. Bette Davis and Joan Crawford pushed off into their like own corners of the industry and celluloid. But they were raised in an industry and worked hard in an industry that was very good to them when it was good, and they wanted that till the very end. And so, you know, it picks up in the early to mid 60s. Okay, yeah. So early to mid 60s when they're making Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And at this point, they've both been in the business for about 30 years. So they were in their waning days of their, they're more past their waning days of their career.
It's still weird to realize that, like, washed up Bette Davis is like 10 years after All About Eve, though. Like,
yeah.
Wrapping your head around that is.
Yeah, and just, they're both supposed to be in like their mid 50s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And and just the commitment to the characters that both of them possess. It made me super emotional because I know so much about them individually and about this movie in particular, especially the strains it took to get a movie like this made, that I felt like whoever did the research and whoever did it was really, really just spot on about mostly everything. The desperation in Joan Crawford when she just is, she believes she's a big star, but she knows that other people know that she's not the big star anymore.
Yeah.
And so the only thing she has is the Oscar that she won for Mildred Pierce and the Pepsi Cola endorsements that she has to stay on top of. And just showing these two women who are basically the same people, but the way their different approaches to life and how they're dealing with this particular period in their lives.
That wake-up scene in the first episode. Ah! We'll talk more about it next week.
I'm jealous.
I know.
You guys really like to torture me, don't you?
You will be missed. You will be missed. Speaking of torture, this week I am all about last week's episode of Girls, American Bitch.
Oh, yeah.
Yes!
So good.
So it is a bottle episode where Hannah Horvath goes to meet with a respected heterosexual male author who she has talked shit about.
Played by Matthew Rhys.
On The All. They go because she has written a think piece based on Tumblr accusations that this guy has been sort of like misusing his power on college tours and having, like, questionable sexual encounters with college students. And then it takes you through a half an hour of stage play, Oleana, are we sort of, like, playing with both sides of this question? Like, is she maligning somebody she doesn't know stories about? Is this person just a guy, like a dorky guy who now finally has his chance for girls to like him? And he's taken advantage of it. And it is everything personal and too close that Girls has been giving us for all of these years, and then ends on a note that was puzzling and fascinating for me as a non-participant in heterosexuality.
Which part? Please just go deeper.
Okay, so spoiler. Like, basically,
because,
like,
I can tell you, and I bet you I know what it is.
Like, when, what do you, what is it?
It's when he pulls his dick out.
It's when he pulls his dick out.
And then she doesn't leave immediately or get horrified.
It's not the normalization of that. It is that that this guy was playing a game, and at the end, he just wanted to put his dick on her because that girl said mean things about him, and yeah. I'm going to put my dick on her. And, like, to some extent, that just doesn't mean, I don't understand that negation through application of genitals, if that makes sense to you.
He actually puts his penis on.
Well, he like turns around and kind of flops it on her, and then she kind of just like reflexively grabs it and then like flips out.
Well, also after this guy who is her hero has been completely grooming her and telling her how smart and great she is, and gives her a signed copy of a Philip Roth novel, and is endorsing her visions of herself.
Yeah.
And then he does that.
I think that it was a completely honest. I've been that girl. You're questioning whether you are like whether I should. I'm feeling something, and it what it feels like is. I don't have to be vulnerable because you find me sexy now. And so now I don't, like, now I have control of the situation. Well, it was, but it's him, it's like, to me, it felt like a power struggle.
It definitely was. I mean, you know, my wife, who worked in the art world for a long time and amongst many people not unlike this character, joked and even posted it publicly so I can share here. She's like, I know that dick, literally and metaphorically.
Yeah.
And, but also to say that, you know, part of it is that, like you're saying, it was meticulously kind of played out as an almost Socratic dialogue, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then you get the situation where I think that she just sort of reflexively. I mean, I think that it did just seem like a reflex.
If you put a dick in front of me and we're having a perfectly fine conversation beforehand, I might touch it.
A vaguely intimate moment, right?
And my question.
I would weigh in on this great dick question, but I haven't seen it yet.
No, my question of uncertainty is
it was flaccid.
Is not like the polite hand job because the situation has presented itself. It's more. Why that, like, it's doing that not because that guy legit wants to have sex with her, but because he wants
control
and power, and he knows his daughter is coming at 3 or whatever, and he is just doing it to change his construction of who Hannah is and who Hannah's construction of
Hannah
is.
And to prove, like, see, you'd take this.
Yeah.
You would take this. You'd be just like one of those girls.
Did you see the what I liked about it is when they show the you know, as it goes out into credits, is Hannah leaves the apartment, and then Desperado by Rihanna plays on Anti, one of her most underrated albums, and all of these streams of women go into the apartment.
Yeah.
And it's like, I just, you know, these men exist all over Hollywood. They're just like, you can't get around them. You have to get through them to get to the next point, no matter what.
They are gatekeepers in the industry.
Yeah. Right?
The thoughtful sleaze, the smart guy.
Yeah.
Who, the smart and reconstituted,
Look at
like,
Casey
masculinity.
Affleck.
Yeah.
Casey Affleck is a perfect example of that. I won an Oscar and I can go on and continue and make my movie, and I can have Kenneth Lonergan support me, and I can have Matt Damon support me, and I just got celebrated. I just got an Oscar.
Are you going to be one of the cool girls?
Yeah, exactly. Someone
noted the cool girl.
that Reese's character looked a lot like. Gave them Casey Affleck vibes.
Oh, total Casey Affleck vibes. I don't think that was done.
I think that was deliberate, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing the bearded Brooklyn hipster variety.
Yes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And the past couple of episodes of Girls generally, however annoyed we were with these people for the first couple of seasons,
it's starting to make sense.
Like, those girls have grown up and you see them being different people. Marnie, maybe not enough.
Oh, but she's the worst.
It's such a good show.
Oh, we'll get back to Marnie later.
All right. We will. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about Get Out after this. Pop Rocket is supported in part by HelloFresh, a meal kit delivery service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. It's really nice having somebody show up to your house with exactly the portions you need to make food for 2 people. I mean, it removes all of the stress and annoyance and time of going and shopping for something, but lets you have that delightful experience of making a homemade meal for yourself. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take about 30 minutes for everybody from novices to seasoned home cooks, short on time. It's all delivered to your doorstep in a special insulated box for free. For $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code ROCKET35 when you subscribe.
My name is Patrick.
My name is Parker.
Max FunCon has been a huge inspiration in my life.
Now I have this network of friends that I've made that span literally across the entire globe, and they're some of my favorite people in the world.
I truly cannot believe the amount of wonderful and lasting friendships that have come out of this.
If you feel like you might not fit in, as long as you're a good person, you'll fit in because everyone there is good and amazing and kind and wonderful, and you should absolutely go. It will be the best decision of your life.
Make a ton of new friends like Parker and Patrick at Max FunCon. Tickets for Max FunCon and Max FunCon East are on sale now at maxfuncon.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
And before we discuss Get Out, we should warn you, there are going to be spoilers. We have to talk about this movie in its entirety. So listen at your own risk. Or hey, if you haven't seen it yet, go see it and then come back and listen to this, and it will be all the richer an experience. So, what expectations did you have going into Get Out? What did you know about it? I knew that it was a low-budget horror film, and I knew that it implicated race in some way.
I also kept myself in the dark and didn't read anything. You know, I had a sense that the horror was going to be about race relations in some way, but I wasn't quite sure how it would play out. So part of me, because I'm a scaredy cat about horror films in general, I was like, am I going to be legit scared or is it going to be funny? I wasn't sure what the kind of emotional pitch was. And I think that it satisfied so many different, like, registers of the emotional experience having seen it.
But yeah. I am also somebody who, like, does not like those tension moments. Mm-hmm. And so they're not normally things that I watch. Even though it was gentle and lovely, it still was a little bit hard for me. But, like, also, in so many ways, this is a movie that should be hard for white people to watch.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was doing its job. Winter, you love horror films.
I love horror movies. This is more of a psychological thriller than a horror film. Mm-hmm. There's definitely, like, slight gore elements to it. But I think being a lover of horror films, that part I was already set up for. So it was like the pie crust was there and the filling could have been anything. And I'm sure it was going to be good.
Margaret, what were you thinking when you went into it?
I tried not to know very much about it either. I did watch the trailer and I knew, because I've seen Key and Peele, that Jordan Peele has this incredible facility with just, like, the language of movies. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's someone who really, like Tarantino in a way, he's
loves,
like,
movies.
He's just inhaled so much that he knows how to speak it super fluently.
That opening shot, or the shot when they are going into the house that just stays static on the whole house while the interaction is going on.
Yes.
So Halloween.
Yeah.
And I want to just mentioned the soundtracking of it, like the sound where I saw it was just amazing, and in fact kept and sustained the soundtracking of the film in general, just sustained the tension even in the earlier parts of it, that, you know, that's what essentially caused all the jump scare moments for me in the beginning, in the first like third of it.
So synopsize the movie for us, Karen. Give us
there is an interracial couple and one of whom is played by Allison Williams and the other by Daniel Kaluuya. And they are going to visit her parents somewhere upstate, I believe, in upstate New York for the weekend. And there's some concern that our protagonist, Chris, has about whether or not she's told her parents that he's black. And, you know, she seems like a particularly woke white lady. They go visit the parents, and many things ensue. That's about it that I'm going to share in terms of a plot synopsis. But essentially, it gives us a sense that it's actually beneath civility and these forms of liberal acceptance come a lot of violences and danger lurking in the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Winter, talk to us about, like, the history of race, and particularly African Americans in horror films, because it is this, like, it's this well-known trope of the black guy
we
dies.
Die.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. My favorite question on our little sheet here. Black people certainly have a lot to be fearful of in the United States, so why haven't we seen many horror films addressing those fears? Because we die. So, you know, the thing about it is that most horror movies that I've seen that started out, if we're talking about, we go back to Night of the Living Dead, which really had the first African-American main character in a horror film, and he was the hero, and he was the savior. And that was definitely a play on what was happening at the time. It was made in 65, and obviously Vietnam, the civil rights mm-hmm. era, all of that was going on. But then if you sort of fast forward and go through it, there weren't really African-American presences, per se, in horror until we got to the early 80s. And then we started seeing them pop up in, slasher movies. But these people usually were either background or to the side. And when you integrated them into horror, into the horror plot, into the plot of the movie, it was farcical, and they were coons, and they were, you know, stereotypes. I always think about in Friday the 13th, I believe it's 4, one of the guys is like a Jerry Curl dancing, twirling rapper, and he gets killed in an outhouse while he's taking a shit. And it's like those type of things where it's just, you know, the black girl is the hottie, but she looks just like a white girl. So there's never really been an opportunity to have a black person as a lead in the film, unless it was a film that was entirely a black, blaxploitation, or it was Tales from the Hood type scenario.
So striking to me was realizing I had never seen a black protagonist negotiate deeply white spaces, because you're either watching 80s style diversity where a black person is a supporting character, or you're watching a black movie that has a largely black cast. In just sort of those early experiences of seeing him with the family and...
Well, the anxiety that you usually feel as someone in the audience is already displaced, because he's feeling anxiety about something. It's not like he's not going to a scary house because the house is scary. They're not going to investigate a scary sound. He's going to investigate progressing his relationship forward, but he needs to know, are your parents going to be tripping? And that anxiety is sort of also layered on top of the anxiety of it being a psychological thriller.
The first legitimate eeriness you get is him experiencing black people who don't respond to the nod. Is fascinating, especially as a white person watching this, because that's something I'm intellectually aware of, but not in any visceral way. So, but these characters of insidious white liberals. Have we seen this in any way before?
I always think of Primary Colors.
Oh, that's interesting.
I just thought of someone who's been completely set up to be the great white hope, and he totally turns out to be insidious and probably a pedophile. There's characters throughout history that have been like this. I'm sure there's more than just what I just thought.
Uncle Tom's Cabin. Where you have the most sympathetic, expressive white female characters often actually in that novel, right? Essentially also being part of the harm around establishing a kind of parameter around what good blackness means.
I mean, if you think about the movie, they love black people. In their minds, they think black people are great, so great that they're prime specimens, so much that they want to be them, so much they want to embody them. Yeah. It's a twisted, fucked up trope.
Yeah, I mean, one of the movies that Jordan Peele talks about emulating or using as a touchstone is Rosemary's Baby. Mm-hmm. And I see it 100% in sense that it's not just about, it's not really about hating the other, it's about sucking their resources or what they perceive as the resources. Mm-hmm. In Rosemary's Baby, it's the woman is the host. She can have a baby. That's a value to this cult. And that's the same thing of what happens here, where there's all these fucked up ideas that these white people have about what it means to be a black man. They squeeze his muscles, they talk about his genitals, all this crazy shit that basically they're pull it in, we need that resource. So it's hatred and fetishization at the same time, just wrapped in this really naughty kind of
So Bradley Whitford as the dad goes with this sort of very campy kind of I love Obama, I wish I could have voted for him a third time. Catherine Keener is this strange and quiet presence. And I couldn't decide whether it was putting a woman in the jeopardized position of having to pull off that kind of like campy comedy? Or what were your guys' thoughts on that?
I feel like throughout the – she has – Catherine Keener is a great actress, but I feel like the entire movie she has these like instances – or where she just, this is, she's not 100% comfortable with this. This is what she has to do, like a Nurse Ratched character.
Although she is most in control, frankly, like of any of the characters in the film.
Yeah.
Like, well, she's the one who actually manipulates and handles everyone physically through her particular skill.
Right.
So
she's
none of
hypnotist.
It is possible. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what the movie spins on in a way, is the fact that she hypnotizes Chris ostensibly to get him to stop smoking, but actually hypnotizes him in this really deep way that gets him prepared to sort of go permanently into the sunken place, as she calls it.
So she commits the greatest violence, essentially.
Yeah, she does. Wow. She basically psychologically preps him for the whole procedure and experience. And I mean, I feel like she is basically supposed to be a witch.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a witch. That's what she is. And it's like the males in the family have force in terms of aggression and masculinity and, like, you know, a more sort of physical presence. Hers is 100% emotional, intuitive, you know, reading his mind, being the earth mother. He's lost his mother.
Yeah.
I mean, she kind of like steps in a bit into that role. So, I think it was basically like, okay, what's the ways in which women can be duplicitous? This is one of the ways that we know classically in horror movies.
Well, and the wonderful thing with the narrative of his mother being dead, of taking a person and saying you are complicit in your own situation. Like, the reason you are unloved is because of what you have done. And it was so insidious. It was so terrible.
I mean, yeah, she puts him on this whole head trip of like, why didn't you, you know, he talks about his mother basically got hit by a car and he was a little boy watching TV and he could have gone out there and possibly rescued her because she was, you know, dead down the block or whatever. And she, you know, takes this teacup and she's sort of tapping her spoon on it periodically. And that's the way she entrances him and sort of gets him to feel guilty that he didn't go out there and basically save his mother, which then, you know, gets him into this mindset that he has to stay with Allison Williams and be by her side.
Yeah.
It's a psychologically castrating gesture, right?
Yes.
It's that you didn't do anything. Like, you failed your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of the original sin.
So yeah. The film sort of, like, starts out by giving us, like, the two, like, the maid and the groundskeeper as the sources of sort of, like, insidiousness and fear.
Right.
But in the long run, turns them into, like, sympathetic and destroyed creatures who are, having to fight with... We haven't properly explained this. Basically, what happens in the movie is that they take out the brains of black people and then put in the brains of white people. So the groundskeeper and the maid are the grandparents.
They keep the black body, basically.
Yeah. They are the grandparents of Allison Williams, but some of their brain stem is still there, and there are ways that, like, the remnants of these black people are able to sort of, like, act and support the story. But I thought it was very interesting that, like, using Mr. West Wing and Catherine Keener gives you these sort of, like, comfortable forces when these strange black people are, like, running at you or, like, scurrying about in the background. But in the long run, you realize they're only products of this system that has been created around them.
Can we give a shout out to Betty Gabriel, who Chris basically says to her, what does he say to her that makes her sort of have that moment where she's like, no, 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 and she, like, almost starts crying and, like, almost breaks, basically. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. She says he says it just makes me really nervous to be around all these white people,
that's,
you know?
That's right. Yeah. And he expects some solidarity from her.
Yeah. And she's like, no.
One thing that's interesting is that little door being opened repeatedly, it's never explained, but my assumption was that some part of Betty was opening that door to try to point him in that direction.
Yes.
Oh.
But this isn't just a family. It was also
I love that. Yeah.
A very sort of like Rosemary's Baby like community
Stepford
of people.
Wives.
But you have this sort of like insidious community like in Rosemary's Baby where they come together for this party that isn't really well explained to our protagonist, and then you eventually realize it's a slave auction where they are going to bid for the right to have his body for whatever purposes. And, like, it is that weird feeling of a strange party full of kind of creepy, clammy people who are just sort of like going up to you and invading you and invading, like, you know, sort of like interrogating you about your identity. Like, why did we go to that in Rosemary's Baby? Why did we come back to that here?
Although the questions weren't that far beyond the pale that people couldn't. African-American people wouldn't experience that on the regular, like, yeah, it as soiree, you know what I mean?
Like, but it's sort I of... feel like that doesn't en masse. That doesn't happen. I certainly don't.
Well, you might get
I
one of those questions every right now and then, you know?
Right.
But you mean the questions from the partygoers that are like, is it true what they say about black men? Like these insidious, yeah, kind of rude, racially overtoned questions. Yeah.
Once you knew what was happening... then it made sense that they were asking, like it was, it, that's what makes it more layered, because though they were asking questions because they want to know what their produce looks like. They, you know, they want to know what is, you know,
they want to know what they're buying.
They want to know what they're buying. She wants a guy with a big dick. Somebody else wants somebody who, you know,
is a good athlete.
Oh, I didn't even think about it. The woman, yeah, who was going after his biceps had a husband in a wheelchair,
yeah,
didn't she?
Yeah.
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 So, she's prepping for the next round.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, but it's interesting because I, while watching it, was very much like, oh, Rosemary's Baby, Rosemary's Baby. But then, like, the Stepford Wives of it is almost, yes, closer, which,
yeah,
is like a novel and then film from the 70s, which was very much about feminism, about this town full of guys who were replacing their wives with robots who would just service them in, like, appropriate ways.
Yeah.
Like, is this more than just the Stepford Blacks?
This is exactly... I loved the Stepford Wives growing up and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And Invasion of the Body Snatchers was a lot more... people were aware of what was happening as it was happening. It was a little bit more obvious because it was an alien invasion. But Stepford Wives, again, the whole notion of moving to this neighborhood that's supposed to provide all of these comforts of what you would seem is like you have it all when you go there. And then on top of that, the residents are like these perfect people. And then you realize what lies beneath. Another great movie that this movie reminded me of, What Lies Beneath, is also another movie about dueling identities and whatnot. But I just think that the Stepford Wives of it all is very much closer to that than I would think it would be the other movie.
Well, one thing I also think is interesting is that they were replacing the minds of these African Americans with old white people.
Yeah.
And the interesting way.
I'm sorry.
Well, sorry.
Just the way that, like, in us.
Lakeith Stanfield's transition.
Oh my God.
Was so. That to me, that being the catalyst for, I know him from somewhere. He doesn't dress like that.
Yeah.
What happened to him? Is
well, also, and when he went crazy, it was the most, like, that was the realest he ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
But the notion that, like, what we are constantly demanding of African Americans is that you comport with a sense of, like, responsible Americanness from 1947,
right,
that no white person is actually, yeah, embodying.
Exactly, exactly.
Although the conditions of the protagonist Chris's purchase had to do also with his unique and particular ability to see the world in a certain way, to have an eye,
yeah,
to have an aesthetic sensibility, a kind of grit to his urban lens, etc., right? That so it was also for at least the person who ends up, you know, eventually buying
Stephen
Chris.
Root.
Yeah, Stephen Root as this blind gallery owner. Jim Hudson, who's like, you know, he's like, yeah, funny, I'm a blind art dealer. But, you know, the it's not just the gift of sight. It's a particular frame of reference, a particular way of seeing that he wanted to own. And I think that says a lot more about the, you know, kind of the conundrum that particularly white liberals feel around their relationship to or fetishization of blackness. And what it mean or what it can mean to give them a particular kind of social or cultural purchase or coolness or whatever.
This community was not exclusively white. There was like one Asian.
It was one person.
Did you guys think that the Asian guy was problematic?
No.
I mean, look, it stood out and it was a very deliberate choice. And it was the character Hiroki Tanaka. who's played by this guy, Yasuko Oyama, who, like, I Googled that name, and the only other thing I found on Google was, like, he was a founder of some martial art, and he would be of approximately the same age, like, in his early 70s. Anyway, I'm curious about that. But, you know, notably, it is this Japanese character, he's not even Japanese American, he's explicitly Japanese, he's explicitly foreign, asks, is the African American experience an advantage or disadvantage? And I think, you know, first and foremost, the fact that this one non-white, other non-white character is another type of race that is kind of, or nationality to, that is fetishized by white people. White people love Japanese people. I mean, more than any other Asian, right? And so that he can kind of be enfolded into this milieu, because there is always the sense that, you know, in the hierarchy of Asian races, that the Japanese were more advanced than everybody else.
Exactly.
So there's that kind of assimilative aspect to it. And also the sense that, you know, by the time the 80s came along, the Japanese had enough money and purchase power to be able to participate in these kinds of things.
Right.
I did read a couple of interesting think pieces about it. One person was offended. One writer named, I guess his name is Mitchell Kuga on Mike, felt really kind of offended by the representation, whereas another, Rainier Munningding on Next Shark, who's a Filipino-American, said, look, actually, this is a wake-up call, Asian Americans. This is how we are complicit as model minorities in, you know, in white supremacy in many respects. And, you know, in continuing to fulfill that role, we have to understand our own kind of complicated history of complicity with white America, with white supremacy. And this is an opportunity to kind of look deeply at that. Although this person is not, again, as I said, Asian American, but it is about a symbol of another kind of status, wealth, and power, Japanese-ness that, you know, filters into the story.
Yeah.
Margaret, we are white.
Yes.
Thank you for reminding me.
Thanks for the teacup, Margaret.
Like, there was something so interesting about walking out of a movie where, like, it just couldn't feel good. You know, it was a wonderful movie, and it was, like, a thrilling experience, and then I got into an elevator at the Grove with three black women who had just seen the movie as well, and, like, there were no jokes I could make. There was, like, I just stood there so awkwardly and had...
Try going to see it with your boyfriend.
Who is of the white persuasion.
What was that experience like?
I know.
For the first 20 minutes, he, like, literally could not... He was, like, sunken down in his seat. Like, he could not... He was not feeling good about it. He felt really nervous and anxious. And then as it progressed along, he felt more comfortable. And we haven't stopped talking about it since, mostly because I think it awakened in him how much he hates many aspects of his whiteness and how much he's not a fan of it, how he doesn't appreciate. It was definitely more like, I can see how this is really uncomfortable for I can see how this is really uncomfortable for you, but why am I more uncomfortable? Can we talk about that? And then explaining his white guilt or what that looks like. And I think that it made him a lot more woke. I think it is a perfect date movie if you're in a racial relationship, because it's not the white black women you need to be worried about. And it's the white women that we're talking about. Felt like an allegory about, like, Kardashian types. If you look at the Kardashians and you look at, like, all the men that they get with, there's a get out situation happening. Kanye's completely needs somebody to flash a camera in his face right
now. But they are Armenian. They're not, like, totally. They're not Allison Williams. You know?
They're not. But there's a.
Literally Caucasian.
But it's insidious almost in nature when you're, like, trying to draw out someone's blackness for yourself and for your gain. In the meantime, one person's, you know, back on drugs. One person is literally losing his mind on stage. It's like those elements. I definitely saw those things.
You know, I do think the movie actually indicts white women in a way the hardest. Because, you know, who ultimately...
Sorry, Margaret.
It was very hard. who ultimately betrays him the most is Allison Williams. Yeah. And
but also her excitement going to find her next prey.
Oh, yeah.
Was,
yeah.
delicious.
Well, and I know some people have criticized the movie for not showing all of the killings, basically, that Chris does at the end, where he escapes, he kills pretty much the whole family. But you don't see him kill Catherine Keener, for instance. It all kind of happens off screen. Even Allison Williams kind of gets off relatively easy. He can't choke her to death.
Yeah.
And I know some people have said, like, what is that about? Like, why couldn't we still have the, like, vengeful killing of these two characters?
Because
who you could say
show a black man
you
killing
can't
white
show
women.
A black man killing a white, especially after OJ. You cannot show that, and I'm glad they didn't show that.
Yeah, I mean, I also think one of the most interesting things about the film is this alternate ending that he didn't end up choosing, but which is supposed to be on the DVD, which is basically, at the end, when we haven't even talked about TSA Rod and how amazing.
We haven't even
What's
talked about him.
The most beautiful thing about Rod is a character from one of those other movies. He's funny black guy.
No, he's the audience. No, he's the audience.
Yeah.
But also he is like funny black supporting character from horror movie who in this movie gets to save the day.
But he's also funny black. He's also like the funny friend in any romantic comedy where he's just there to support you while you make crazy decisions.
But the alternate ending was not going to be him pulling up. It was going to be a cop who would arrest Chris and
How bleak would that have felt?
Super bleak. I'm glad he didn't do it in the end.
Everybody already felt that, though. The thing is that the minute we saw those lights reflecting, we're just like,
and he holds up his hands because he already knows he would be the one to be arrested out of this scenario.
The whole theater already knew the ending. That's the whole point, is that everybody already anticipated and understood that would be
but
the ending.
But the whole theater erupted when it was him.
Absolutely. Yes. But the whole point is that we expected the bleaker ending.
Yes.
And we were already ready to go.
We were already
there.
Primed.
Yeah,
for
we were
it.
Primed.
Yeah.
Let's answer a couple of questions from Facebook. What was the first horror movie you watched, and where did you realize that there was a deeper meaning to it? I think I saw Nightmare on Elm Street really early, and I never realized that there were deeper meanings to them. Like, I later was like, there are like these sort of like. These genres that I never cared about that I later realize are like political or interesting, but it's still very hard for me to like get into them. You deeply love horror.
I mean, pretty much of the Dead series, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Night of the Living Dead, they all have deeper meanings, but Dawn of the Dead, to me, was when I realized it's Dawn of the Dead is shot in 78 in the middle of Pennsylvania, and it's it's set in a shopping mall and shot in a shopping mall. And these survivors end up living in this shopping mall while the zombie invasion happens for close to a year because a baby's born there. And that's when it was talking about like conspicuous consumption, consumerism, mass consumerism, like people just the idea that a zombie takeover would happen inside of a shopping mall and then you're trapped in the shopping mall. You can't leave the shopping mall, but it has everything you need, so it makes it the perfect situation. That's when I first realized, wow, this is a really layered movie. And obviously Night of the Living Dead, when it happened, when it was set, and it's the whole era of it, has all the ties to civil rights.
I mean, horror or like the villains or protagonists, however we want to call them, the people committing horror in horror films tend to be people who are outcast, who have suffered some sort of trauma, who have been derided as children. And there's a lot of that feels very queer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's always the kind of pretty jocks and girls who are like popular in high school who end up getting slashed first in these slasher flicks. So it is a kind of at once a revenge of the nerds of revenge of the kind of the outcast kids situation in many like stock horror genres. And that I always held on to, even though it's, I couldn't handle the levels of fear that it required to actually sit through one.
I think in a way, like, the very first horror movie, I thought there was some kind of deeper meaning to it, but I wouldn't have known how to articulate it. My brothers forced me to watch The Exorcist when I was, like, 8 or 9
years
old.
Yeah, that's
it gave
scary.
It gave me nightmares for, like, 2 nights. But, I knew even seeing it then, even though I couldn't have explained it to you, obviously, at 8 or 9, that it, like, there's something deeply meaningful about seeing a child, the supposed innocent, like, completely taken over by the devil and, like, all that means about, surrender and religion and how it manifests. And I think that all horror movies, even the stupidest slasher ones, still have a deeper meaning of just fear of death, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That was from Joe Smith. From Kenesha Hill Phillips, how do we feel in general about comedy horror crossovers?
I think that they tend to work. I mean, you know, I know what they did. I know what you did last summer. Like, you know, that's pretty skip. Scream was a huge success.
The Scream films maybe were the first horror films that I really deeply, legitimately enjoyed because they're overt commentary on, like, the gender politics of horror films. Like, that moment when Neve Campbell shoves her finger into the dude's gash. I was electrified.
I think that comedy and horror crossing over, this is the best way to do it right when it, because there was a social commentary on it. Mm-hmm. But I've never really, like, there's always a social commentary. Like with Scream, it was a turn on slasher movies. It was redoing slasher movies and putting it into the hands of people that seem to be too old to be in high school, but it reinvented that genre, but it needed that comic relief.
And final question, Nick Wester and We Have Snacks both asked the question, what breed of dog was Sid?
Oh, boy.
Oh, man. I mean,
like a Benji-esque dog, right? What kind of breed is that?
I mean, I don't know dog breeds unless it's my own dog, but I would just call that dog breed Fuzzy Nutter. That's what I would go with. That's a question for Can I Pet Your Dog?
Yeah.
I know.
Look, Chris and Rose did have an amazing apartment, though. And after her murder or death, I would like to find out how much that place rents for. You are listening to Pop Rock. We're going to be right back after this. All right, you guys. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Mack Weldon is dedicated to offering the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and more that you will ever wear. They have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor, which is very important for all of us. They want you to be comfortable. So if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they will still refund you. No questions asked. And I think when it comes to all of our underwear, we would like to live in a situation where there are no questions asked. Not only does Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well, too. It's good for working out, going to work, going out on dates, most of the things that you do in underwear, which is most of the things you do in life. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code ROCKET. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Thompson.
Now, Winter, every week on the show, we ask a question, and you're not going to be here next week, so you really need to savor this one, okay?
Yes.
Are you ready for the question?
Yes, I am, sir.
Winter Mitchell, what is your current jam?
My song is called Something by Fonte, and I heard this in a Lyft ride, and it's the Joe Kay is the producer who creates Soul Lection, which are about 45-minute mixtape. Ish type scenarios, and Lyft drivers seem to always have really good Lyft drivers always play the right kind of music. You only get them once in a blue moon, but this guy was really doing the right thing, so I like this song. Do you like this guy?
I like it. Okay. It's kind of $14 cocktail lobby.
Yes, it's $14 cocktail lobby. Maybe $20 cocktail lobby if you're in San Francisco.
Margaret, you got a jam?
I sure do. I got Sharon Van Etten's cover of singer Skeeter Davis's 1962 hit, The End of the World. And this is basically from a soundtrack to the Amazon series, The Man in the High Castle, which I kind of fell out of myself, and this is making me want to get back into it. But the whole soundtrack was created by Danger Mouse and producer Sam Cohen. And it's this conceptual kind of soundtrack that is meant to be a collection of songs that would be broadcast by rebels in that world's neutral zone. So here's the end of the world.
Why does the sun go on shining? Why does the sea rush to shore? Don't they know it's the end of the world? 'Cause you don't love me anymore.
Wow. I love this song.
Doesn't this feel like it should be in a David Lynch movie where somebody yes. gets murdered in the middle of the song? Yeah, I really love it. I mean, her voice is beautiful, and this is the perfect song for her to cover. The album is called Resistance Radio, and it has songs from Beck, Nora Jones, Karen O, Granddaddy, a bunch of people. So it's coming out in April.
Margaret, I have a homework assignment for you, okay?
Yes, yes, please.
Okay, so there is this world of things. Here we are at peak television.
Okay.
And there is this strata of television that is not quite prestige television. It is aspiring to prestige television. Maybe it's something really good that nobody watches, like Underground. Maybe it's something that is high production value, but maybe not as captivating as major prestige television, like Man in the High Castle, which both of us enjoyed the idea of and then just sort of fell out of.
Yes.
And so your assignment, and people who are listening and others in this room are also allowed to work on this, but it's more
extra credit.
Margaret's
extra credit.
Running point on this, okay?
All right.
Is what do we call that television?
Like the sub-prestige television?
Sub-prestige television.
Ooh.
Okay. Yeah. I got it.
Aspirational premium? Imposter fragrance
like
premium?
Like the Detour? Nobody watches the Detour, and I don't
Designer
understand.
Imposter
Designer
prestige.
Imposter prestige.
If you love Calvin Klein's one. All I saw right now is the commercial of it walking down the red carpet yeah, trying to be somebody.
In a spray bottle.
In a spray bottle.
That's so
poor
funny.
Designer imposter.
Tongson, you got a jam?
I do have a jam. It's an old jam that I've always enjoyed from the early 90s by the band Go West, whose best work was really in the late 80s or mid to late 80s. But this was kind of like their, I would call it their oops baby. Like, you know, when, you know, couples have had several kids, then in their 40s, they have like, you know, oops, there's our fourth kid. This was the kind of their oops hit that came out in 1992. And it's called The King of Wishful Thinking.
Want to be in a chess king so
right?
bad, girl.
I mean, is this the soundtrack to a Whoopi Goldberg comedy?
Like, no, it's right? definitely Kirstie
yeah.
Alley.
Practically, yeah, exactly. It's like, or that like belated mannequin tribute like film that they
yeah.
were
no, this is a montage too. For sure. Somebody's yeah. like, we're
it's
gonna make
montage.
You over.
It's a great, it's one of those karaoke songs that's not overdetermined, like Total Eclipse of the Heart, but when someone like chooses it and sings it, you're like, this is the perfect karaoke.
I would applaud,
song.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that is my jam. It's on their album Indian Summer from 1992. And it was brought back into
this
my.
This was in 1992?
Yeah, right? It's like kind of like really late to be of that Robbie Neville-esque
yeah.
like sound. But also, it was brought back into my consciousness from a designer imposter prestige show, Halt and Catch Fire, which I really love.
Oh, and it's in its last season now, right?
Is
well,
that
was
happened?
On purpose.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah. Is it coming? I think the last season is coming up. I'm not sure if it's
okay.
started
yeah.
yet, but it's like we're getting to the point of the invention of the internet now. And so, like,
finally.
I think that finally once that happens, it's sort of like, okay, like, what do we do now?
It's been a lot of leg warmers and.
Exactly.
I feel
you
like
know.
I would have liked that show, but I completely missed it.
It's amazing, actually.
Okay. I'm sorry that it's time for my jam now, you guys. And I'm sorry about the extent to which I have been forcing you to go through my romance with Calypso.
No.
But it's important to understand that last week was Carnival, and at Carnival, like in Port of Spain, like you name the king of Calypso for the year. Now, the king of Calypso was a guy, I think, named like the Mighty Chalkboard or something like that.
The king
what
of wishful
about
thinking.
The queen? Yeah.
I'm getting there.
Thank
wow.
you.
Okay. So, like, his song was about child marriage in Trinidad and, like, had some interesting racial undertones. But a song that got a decent amount of play and had a lot of attention was from Calypso Rose, the first woman to be named Queen of Calypso, afterward, after which it became, like, officially monarch of Calypso. But she had a great song. And the thing I love about Calypso is that it manages to be deeply political while always fun. And let's listen to a little bit of it. So this song is called Leave Me Alone and is basically about women having, like, sovereignty over their own bodies.
Nice.
And is like, let me go jump up and dance with the band and everything. Let me grind without you feeling the need to grab my ass every time. It's pretty exciting.
Guy, if you bring this kind of music in and don't bring liquor or Mardi Gras beads, at least, I'm going to be upset next
time. At least bring a king cake.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair.
With the baby
with
in
the
there.
Baby in it.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brandon, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Waffler, and Karen Thompson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to absolutely nobody for the five-star reviews on iTunes.
Fuck up.
If you haven't,
we've been putting ourselves out here,
this
people.
Really, really,
guys,
really
we need to get this shit together. Where are you right now? If you're somebody who's listened for a while and has just never actually reviewed us, please review us. You guys can get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join in the discussion. Oh, also, I should have done this earlier in the show, but I have a television program that's coming out on April 5th, so I need to start plugging that now. Set your TiVos when possible, but Talk Show the Game Show is coming to True TV, and get a load of it. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the festive Christian Dwayne S.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.